What could they have done?
You know, a lot of the infectious disease experts I talked to, Steve, say the best way to do this is to recommend or require that people do an over-the-counter test on day 5 before they come out of isolation. I spoke to Dr. Aaron Carroll of Indiana University about this.
I don't think the Biden administration has moved fast enough or far enough to make antigen tests widely available to people and to make them economically available to everyone.
You know, the administration has made it clear that it's a priority to ramp up production and distribution, and they've been saying this for a while, so I think the pressure is really on to deliver now.
Is it better understood how serious the Omicron variant is in most cases? Is it a milder strain?
You know, I think that's still a bit of an open question. I think we can look at data from other countries, including the UK and Denmark, and what's beginning to be seen here in the US, where there's more and more evidence that it does appear to be less virulent, less likely to cause severe illness, particularly in people who are vaccinated. With unvaccinated people, we've seen time and time again they're hit harder by COVID, and certainly there are people hospitalized right now with Omicron.
That's NPR's Allison Aubrey. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Next, we have Jean Ross. She is the co-president of the nation's largest union for registered nurses, the National Nurses United. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
What do you make of the new guidelines?
Well, we're disappointed. We operate on the precautionary principle. Instead of having to make sure that it's absolutely proven that you aren't contagious after 5 days, we would say go ahead and stay with the 10 and then even ramp up your recommendations. For example, give full credence to the fact that it is an airborne virus and insist on the right type of masks and the multi-layered approach to infection control, which includes everything, including the vaccine.
What do you think of the question of practicality here, that in, especially in essential industries, maybe most of all in healthcare, where people are so stressed and so strained, the benefit of keeping people out of work an extra 5 days is not worth the cost?
I think it's penny wise, pound foolish. We're already strained, and putting us at risk for more transmission, illness, and death is not going to help the fact that we're short of people working right now.
You know, I have noticed, I mean, I know some people who work in the healthcare industry, people who work in hospitals, and from time to time, it's anecdotal, of course, I hear stories of people who didn't even get the 10 days. They're asked, you tested positive, can you take the weekend off and be back Monday because we really need somebody there and you're going to be wearing a mask and you're working around people with COVID. Like, they've essentially justified much shorter isolation periods as it is. Does that happen a lot?
It does. Those of us who have a union contract, it's easier for us to, you know, enforce and stand up for ourselves. But if you don't have one, you're pretty much threatened to come back to work or else. And then to make matters worse, we had our OSHA emergency temporary standard that lapsed on December 21st. They haven't made it permanent yet, and that gives employers leeway to not do the right thing and continue to supply us with the proper PPE, including the masks I mentioned, the respirators, instead of just face masks.
What would you have the government do then in this situation to make things more sustainable for your nurses in the no doubt difficult couple of months ahead?
Making that temporary standard from OSHA permanent would go a long way in helping us. It would help us enforce the protections that we need. So far, the employers have shown us that unless they're mandated, they're not going to do the right thing.
Jean Ross is president of National Nurses United. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Now, Delta's CEO, as we mentioned, may have wanted a shorter isolation time, but the Association of Flight Attendants does not. They have called the revisions the wrong move, and the Association of Flight Attendants President Sarah Nelson is our next guest. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's wrong with 5 days?
The problem is that we are admitting that we're going to put infectious people back into the workplace or on our planes. We were really concerned because Delta was proposing this as they were talking about staffing shortages. Director Walensky has recognized that once again in her comments, that this was in response to the concerns from the business community. And we want to be focused on public health and ending this pandemic. So we're very concerned about this, and we are pressing the airlines to have policies that are much better than what the CDC is giving as a minimum standard.
Let's interrogate something you said there. You said we're admitting we're going to put infectious people back onto planes. Rochelle Walensky, the head of the CDC, has said, generally speaking, people who are infectious for 3 days, not 5 days. And so if you test positive, 5 days in most cases, if not all cases, should be enough. And in those limited cases where somebody is infectious longer, they're wearing a mask. What is she missing?
Well, of course, we found out that the CDC's own science wasn't correct in which strain of coronavirus was the most dominant in the United States. We were still operating with Delta as the most dominant, not Omicron. So there's evolving science here. We also understand that these variants are cropping up as the virus is continuing to exist. And in most cases is really not good enough. That's exactly recognizing that there will be some people who are still infectious who are coming back to work. That's exactly what we're saying. So we're saying we need to be very careful here. And even the airlines that were pressing for this reduction from 10 days to 5 days were saying that it should only be for breakthrough cases and after testing. So there are holes here that give us a lot of unknowns and a lot of uncertainty. And that is the last thing that we need. Uncertainty has led to violence on our planes. It has led to people not trusting the government and not knowing what to do. It has led to people not getting vaccinated. And so all of this is really a concern in if we're talking about the long-term goal here of ending this pandemic.
What about we talk about Delta Airlines. We could name any number of airlines that had hundreds of canceled flights just over Christmas. What about their concern about simply keeping the economy going, keeping the planes in the air?
Well, I think we're choosing the economy over public health. And let's be really clear, there were other airlines that negotiated with us for incentives for people to come to work. Delta is the only major airline that flight attendants don't have a contract, and they did not offer those incentives. So there are other ways to deal with this, and they don't need to ask the government to clean up their mess in poor planning.
In just a few seconds, what do you make of the discussion of a possible vaccine requirement to board a plane, which, to be clear, is not something the government is doing, but many people are calling for?
We support this in principle, but we also understand that there has to be a way to check vaccine status and not have this backed up. And in this country, we have not kept track of vaccine status so that there's an easy way to do that. We think it's more important than ever with these new guidelines from the CDC that we all get together and try to make that work. But right now, that's not possible.
Yeah, the question is how you would find out that the person with the boarding pass is also vaccinated and can prove it. Sarah Nelson of the Association of Flight Attendants, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And since there was a dispute about the science there, let's go even a little bit deeper. We've brought back NPR's Allison Aubrey. And Allison, what did you make of the criticism of the CDC science there?
You know, she said the CDC's own science wasn't correct on which variant was most dominant, though it's important to point out that the CDC had said its early Omicron numbers were an estimate. As new numbers came in, they revised that estimate and landed on about 59% of cases last week. It's not a mistake as much as it is an update based on new data. And indeed, Omicron does make up most of the cases.
The real question here, though, is what does the science show about 5 days?
All of the infectious disease experts I spoke to yesterday say the 5-day isolation rule is reasonable given the accumulating evidence if people mask up and ideally take a test. So bottom line, the 5-day policy is most likely to succeed if people follow this guidance. It's not guaranteed that people are not infectious, but a mask offers that extra layer of protection.
NPR's Allison Aubrey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 19 past 8. It's Wednesday, and later this hour, we'll have Wisconsin Life for you, a story about daydreaming and how it can help some people get through incredibly difficult times.
People are still trying to process that the economy is probably not going back to the way it used to be.
Outside of pandemic time, if we look at what very often happens for people grieving a death, the second year is when it starts to sort of settle in that, oh, this isn't changing.
I'm Kimberly Adams, the language of grief, next time on Marketplace.
You can hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, home to 1,500 undergraduate students from nearly every state and more than 50 countries. Dedicated to an engaging global education. lawrence.edu.
WGTD FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
Forecast today, sunny for the northern half of the state, a mix of sun and clouds elsewhere, highs ranging from around 10 in the north to the upper 20s in the south.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, supporting human rights advocates worldwide as they respond to COVID-19 and defend democratic rights. Learn more at ajws.org. From Novo Nordisk, working to improve the lives of people with obesity through knowledge, science, and compassion, because obesity is a matter of biology, not just willpower. More at truthaboutweight.com. From Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on helping organizations adapt to change and prepare for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Sarah McCammon. A lot of Chinese cities don't make money through taxation. Instead, they sell land. It's a financial model that's made cities rich. It's also created a lot of debt that China now wants to limit. NPR's Emily Feng visits one city that's experiencing this.
The city of Nanning in tropical Guangxi province was once effectively a cluster of villages just four decades ago. Today, those villages still exist, but they've been swallowed up by fast-growing city around them. Visit Nanning today, and you'll find dozens of what's called Chengzhongcun urban villages. And in the rush to urbanize, these villages, too, became crowded with high-rise buildings. Miss Luo remembers how Ma Cun, or Ma Village, used to be surrounded by fields of water spinach. Like other residents in this piece, she didn't want to give her full name for fear of political sensitivities because the villages are constantly under threat of demolition.
In the mid-1980s, much of the village land was expropriated by the local government to build public roads and government offices.
Today, these urban villages are a warren of cheap housing. And around them, the city was also undergoing a dramatic buildup. It all began with a change in tax law in 1994 that sent most tax revenue to the central government, leaving local governments with very little cash.
Now, things become problematic for local governments because they have so many policy pressures placed upon them.
This is Denny McMahon, the author of the book China's Great Wall of Debt. He explains local governments scrambled to find new ways to raise money, and they settled on selling land to build infrastructure. Specifically, new skyscrapers and train stations and highways.
They build things borrowing from the banks. The banks lend to them because they have land as collateral. And then when it comes time to pay down those loans, it comes from the local governments selling the land to property developers. And that is kind of this cycle of finance between the banks, the property sector, and the local governments.
The local governments paid for all this shiny new stuff with its ample land reserves, because the state effectively owns all land in China. And developers and new property owners made money and supported the economy. Nanning is an active participant in this cycle. According to consultancy Rhodium Group, the city is one of the most vulnerable in China to debt risks, because Nanning currently holds debts equal to more than 14 times its entire annual revenue. Debts they plan to pay back by selling more land. Logan Wright, the Rhodium analyst who spearheaded this report, explains that everyone considered this kind of land financing to be fail-proof because it was effectively guaranteed by the government.
Most people believed essentially that the property market was too big to fail, that local governments would, in times of stress, needed to sell land, and therefore they had to support the market
Local governments do have strict limits on how much debt they can take out. To get around this, they create state-controlled shell companies to take out those loans on their behalf, thus keeping the debt off their books. Many analysts call these shell entities local government financing vehicles. And these vehicles aren't all bad. They helped finance the construction of essential public infrastructure. Miss Liu, a seamstress, repairs a pair of pants as she remembers what it was like when she moved into Wenzhou Urban Village 15 years ago.
Conditions now are much better. Before, there were open gutters. Now the village is serviced by metro stations and paved roads.
This whole debt juggling act worked while economic growth was high and the price of land kept growing so governments could continue to pay off their debts. What changed this year was Beijing finally began enforcing a policy called the Three Red Lines, which were hard caps on how much debt property developers could take on. That meant developers like the embattled Evergrande Group are buying less land. Local governments saw land sale revenues plunge by as much as 40% month on month, meaning they now also struggle to pay back their debts, much of it on China's bond market.
Therefore, you could see a wave of contagion throughout the bond market if those start defaulting in larger volumes, as basically investors will have to start looking around at risks at local governments themselves.
Several property developers, not just Evergrande, are teetering on the edge of default. And local governments are facing some tough years ahead as they face mounting debts they have no way to pay. China has been trying to tamp down on property speculation and shadowy debt for years. So economics commentators like Lizzie Lee are asking, why is Beijing cracking down now on the property sector?
China is sort of at the threshold of another era when the disadvantages of that kind of runaway growth became more apparent, especially in terms of income inequality.
And next year, Chinese leader Xi Jinping heads a Communist Party enclave where he'll likely extend his rule. Getting the property sector and debt under control before then will be a priority. In Nanning, none of these financial risks are visible. Instead, glassy shopping malls and sprawling apartment complexes are a testament to the power of land financing. Yet symptoms of China's economic slowdown are being felt. Miss Li, a fruit seller, says she's hurting for business.
All the workers moved away. There's no work and few new building projects.
Signs advertising empty apartments for rent are ubiquitous in the urban villages. Many shops have closed. Nanning City statistics show the volume of real estate sold dropped more than 47% in the city in November compared to the same time the year before. All signs the invisible mechanisms that power this economy of 1.4 billion people are changing. Emily Fang, NPR News, Nanning, China.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, New York City is scaling back its New Year's Eve celebrations because of skyrocketing COVID cases. Hear how other parts of the country are trying to balance ringing in 2022 both safely and in style. Listen to that story by asking your smart speaker to play your member station by name. This is NPR News.
Sergeant Aquilino Gonell was injured guarding the Capitol on January 6th. 1 year on, the memory of that day continues to take its toll on him and his family.
They see me cry. They cry with me.
Hear his story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. The latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio is just ahead. One story today, the Omicron variant of the coronavirus has more than doubled in Wisconsin. We'll hear the details in just a few minutes.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Former President Bill Clinton says former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid was a tough negotiator who was never afraid to make an unpopular decision if it meant getting something done that was right for the country. Reid died yesterday at age 82 following a four-year battle with pancreatic cancer. NPR's Marie Andrusevich says Reid was a Democrat who represented Nevada in Congress for more than 30 years.
Former President Barack Obama, who had help from Reid in passing the Affordable Care Act, sent him a letter shortly before his death saying, "I wouldn't have got most of what I got done without your skill and determination." One-time rival and former Republican House Speaker John Boehner, who co-chaired a bipartisan think tank with Reid, said although they disagreed on many things, they were always honest with each other and that honesty became a bond. Current House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Senator Reid will be remembered as one of the most impactful leaders of the Senate in history. Marie Andrusevich, NPR News, Washington.
Police in Colorado say five people shot and killed this week in and around Denver were targeted by a gunman who was later killed by law enforcement. Investigators say the suspect had previous personal or business dealings with each. Two others were wounded by gunfire, including a police officer in Lakewood. She's expected to make a full recovery. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Several federal and state endangered mussels thought to be more than 100 years old were found in the Upper St. Croix River in western Wisconsin this past summer. Researchers were surprised to find eight spectacle case mussels still alive after not searching for them since 1987. Wisconsin DNR conservation biologist Lisi Kitchell says reestablishing the mussels is unlikely in the Upper St. Croix since the habitat for the host fish needed to help reproduce the spectacle case no longer exists.
That population, unfortunately, is probably just going to die off, but we will keep monitoring it over time to just see how long these guys will live. They've been living a long time.
It's thought the mussels could date to 1907 when the dam was built. Public health officials are becoming increasingly concerned with what they call a, quote, significant number of people leaving their jobs in the wake of burnout and a barrage of threats in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to WISN-TV. Milwaukee's Health Commissioner Kirsten Johnston said Monday that, quote, certainly we have all faced email and verbal threats. Johnston said the trend is mirrored across the state and country. In Milwaukee, Johnston said a significant number of public health workers have left their jobs, sometimes making it a challenge to fully staff testing and vaccination sites. Jefferson County's public health director, Gail Scott, said on WISN's Upfront program that she has been threatened with firing, with gun violence, and with being taken to court for crimes against humanity. Scott is retiring in January after some 40 years of service. The Omicron variant of the coronavirus has more than doubled in Wisconsin, the Journal Sentinel reports. The Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene at UW-Madison reported Tuesday that more than 67% of tests sequenced during the week of December 20th were the Omicron variant. During the week of December 13th, fewer than 30% of tests sequenced were the Omicron variant. The Wisconsin Hospital Association reported an increase in total patients hospitalized with COVID-19 to 1,672 patients Tuesday, up 279 patients from a month ago. In WPR weather, sunny for the northern half of the state, a mix of sun and clouds elsewhere, highs ranging from around 10 in the north to the upper 20s in the south. It's WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from MGM with Licorice Pizza, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, about the navigation of first love, starring Alana Haim, Cooper Hoffman, Sean Penn, and Bradley Cooper. Now in select theaters, everywhere Christmas. From Autism Speaks, Autism Speaks is working to create a world where all people with autism can reach their full potential. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Former Senate Leader Harry Reid has died at the age of 82. His wife, Landra Reid, said his death came after a four-year battle with pancreatic cancer. Reid was a Nevada Democrat But he was much more than that. He was the Senate majority and minority leader during the Obama presidency. Had a major effect on the course of the country. And NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis remembers what a character he was.
Harry Reid was a lot of things, but he was most often proud of what he was not. His distaste for the Washington social scene was so well known, he often bragged about how often he turned down party invitations, as he did here in his Senate farewell address in 2016.
So during my 34 years in Congress, I have approximately 135 or 36 of these. I've attended one of them. For me, that was enough.
Reid's rise in politics was never attributed to his social skills. His lifelong habit of ending phone calls by simply hanging up when he was done with a conversation was the stuff of Washington legend. Here's then-Vice President Joe Biden speaking at a Reid tribute before he left the Senate.
Harry, I gotta admit, years to come, every time I hear a dial tone, I'll think of Harry.
To understand how this soft-spoken, antisocial senator rose up the political ranks, it's necessary to understand where he came from. Reid was born in a wooden lean-to, with no electricity or plumbing, in the impoverished town of Searchlight, Nevada, population 250. His father was a miner, and his mother earned money by doing laundry for the town's brothels.
The big business while I was growing up was prostitution. You know, all up in there, there's one time as many as 13 houses of prostitution. That's what kept the town jumping.
That was Reid speaking to NPR from Searchlight in 2004, shortly after he was elected Democratic minority leader by his colleagues for the first time. Reid liked to say he made it out of that town because he was a fighter, literally. He was an amateur boxer in high school, and he brought that same pugilist attitude to politics, which he once described this way.
I always would rather dance than fight, but I know how to fight.
And fight he did. Reid led Senate Democrats for more than a decade, from 2005 until his 2016 retirement. It was an era defined by a rise in the polarization of the once clubby atmosphere of the United States Senate. Reid's defining moment as leader came in 2013, when he made the controversial decision to blow up longstanding Senate filibuster rules to make it easier for President Obama to get most of his nominations through a gridlock Senate. Reid defended the decision this way.
The rule change will make cloture for all nominations other than the Supreme Court a majority threshold vote, yes or no. The Senate is a living thing, and to survive it must change, as it has over the history of this great country.
Republicans opposed the move and warned there would be consequences. Here's then-Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Say to my friends on the other side of the aisle, you'll regret this, and you may regret it a lot sooner than you think.
McConnell was right. After Republicans won control of the Senate in 2014, he cited the Reid precedent to push through a rules change to eliminate the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees in 2017. It paved the way for Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh to join the court and forever changed how the Senate approves a president's nominees. But Reid had no regrets. In a final editorial for the New York Times, Reid wrote the rules change was the right thing to do. Plus, regret simply wasn't his style. Susan Davis, NPR News, The Capitol.
And let's talk more now about the legacy of Senator Harry Reid with Faz Shakir. He served as a senior advisor to Reid. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We heard that Senator Reid was not your typical D.C. politician. He didn't have much time for the social scene that so often goes hand in hand with building relationships in D.C. So what was it about him that enabled him to rise and lead the Senate?
Yes, that's right. He was even short on phone calls. Some people didn't even know when he had hung up on you because he was off and running to the next thing. But what made him so effective, you think about this, somebody who was voted a leader by his peers, is that he had this father-like qualities about him in the most traditional sense. When you think of a father, somebody who knows his children very well, he knows what makes them tick. He's looking out for them. He wants the best for them. He's giving them opportunities to succeed. That was Harry Reid, not only with his own intimate family, but with the entire Democratic caucus, with his staff, with the president of the United States. He was a father-like figure. People trusted his judgment. They were loyal to him in service, and they wanted to know what direction should we go, and trusted that when he was making a decision, he was not making it for himself, he was making it for all of us.
As we also heard, Reid had a very modest upbringing in Nevada. How did those experiences shape the way he went about legislating?
He comes from an old school cloth where class politics was alive and people remembered where they came from, especially in this day and age, Sarah. You think about people who run for office, they come with millions of dollars already, and they're, you know, that's one of the ways in which we recruit for candidates. Here's a candidate who, a person, Harry Reid, who comes from poverty. And he never forgot it. He never forgot the people he came from. He fought for Social Security forever and to expand Social Security because that was so integral to his own life and to his own upbringing to be able to survive. I mean, he fought for community health centers and health care expansions because he felt it in his own mother who lost her teeth, or his brother who was writhing in pain from a leg injury. I mean, those are things that were seared in his head. And, you know, you go down the line, he fought against trade deals because he felt the working class of America was going to lose out from them. So he opposes all these trade deals that most other politicians supported. He fought for climate change. I mean, he was almost a clairvoyant about it in politics. He was seeing beyond the corners and saying, look, I see it in my own state that we're going to be suffering from the effects of climate change, and in many ways led his own state to be a bold entrepreneur on renewable energy.
What would you say, and what would he have said, was his biggest political accomplishment?
Oh, my goodness. If you were talking to him, he would always, of course, say something about his own family. I mean, I remember a conversation he had in which the only time I can remember Harry Reid tearing up. And he talked about when one summer, as he was growing up, he worked at a gas station and earned some money and was able to buy his mother some teeth. And it would get him every single time. It meant the world to her to have teeth in her mouth. And he, you know, had a role to play in earning money to do that. But I think, you know, his legacy outlives some of the things that I know he would be proudest of, because they would be his personal relationships. In many ways, he spawned a whole generation, as I say, of people who feel part of him, feel part of his family, feel part of Team Reid. And I'm sure all of us will be talking about him with great pride for years to come. And if I have anything to say about it, so will my kids talking about it with their kids.
I've got to ask you really quickly. You mentioned that habit of hanging up the phone that he had. How often were you hung up on by Senator Reid?
Well, the funny thing about it is he never said goodbye. So you never knew when it was the end of the conversation. So you'd sometimes be talking to yourself because he had already off and run. And so I got used to it. And I said, hey, Senator, I'll see you later. So I would preemptively tell him goodbye.
Well, I've got to tell you goodbye now. But thank you, Faz Shakir, for joining us. He's a former senior advisor to the late Senator Harry Reid. Thanks again.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up in 9 minutes, Morning Edition highlights the work of some of the show's producers. They play a major role in shaping what you hear on this program every day. They'll talk about some of their most memorable stories of 2021.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's more than a century of information, connection, and inspiration for the people of Wisconsin. When you give, you ensure that WPR's bright future includes plenty of in-depth news, world-class music, and thought-provoking discussions and entertainment. Thank you for supporting the important role of WPR in your community with your year-end gift right now at wpr.org/donate.
Support for WPR comes from Alliant Energy, adding up to 1,000 megawatts of solar generation for sustainable energy in Wisconsin by the end of 2023. More at AlliantEnergy.com/WisconsinBlueprint.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Dementia care specialists provide free support and education for people with dementia and their caregivers to ensure quality of life while living at home. Call 262-605-6646.
To Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are some of the day's news stories. China is calling on the United States to protect a Chinese space station and its three-member crew after Beijing complained that satellites launched by Elon Musk's SpaceX nearly struck the station. The foreign ministry accused Washington of ignoring its treaty obligations to protect the Tiangong's crew following the incidents in July and October. The Chinese government said in a complaint to the United Nations that the Tiangong performed, quote, evasive maneuvers on July 1st and October 21st to prevent a potential collision with Starlink satellites launched by Space Exploration Technologies Corporation. Snow, ice, and unseasonable cold in the Pacific Northwest and the Sierra Nevada are continuing to disrupt traffic, cause closures, and force people to find refuge in emergency warming shelters. Across western Wisconsin and Oregon, officials said private groups opened emergency places for people as forecasters said the cold could last until this weekend. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR just after 9.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Heifer International, changing lives one gift at a time. This holiday season, people can use their matchmaking quiz to find gifts. Learn more at heifer.org/radio. From Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide and user reviews to help people find tires that fit their needs and driving conditions. Learn more at TireRack.com. And from the ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
It's 8:45 now and time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about survival.
Dreaming can help some people get through incredibly difficult times. Madison's Tondalea Taylor talks about how daydreaming helped her overcome a major health crisis and appreciate everyday life.
You want to know what I love? I love traveling, great earrings and purses. I mean, who wouldn't love to shop every day, all day, with not a care or worry in the world? I envision myself walking through the airport with my favorite pair of Black Queen earrings, my cute matching crossbody purse, taking a first-class flight to the Bahamas. I find myself doing that all too often. When I daydream, it was starting to affect my day job. Daydreaming was good to me until I had an unexpected visitor that would put my daydreaming into jeopardy. I had been feeling horrible for a few months. I was so tired, I almost couldn't make it to the doctor appointment. I finally dragged myself to the doctor. Never planned out in my mind that I would drive to the doctor, but I would ride in the ambulance to the emergency room. Mm-hmm. 8 hours later, one doctor came in and said, "You look good compared to what your body is going through, so we're going to keep you overnight." I suddenly had a sigh of relief. After another doctor came in and told me he ran every test he could possibly run, and he said I had leukemia. Mm. Then I called my mom and said they think I have cancer, even though he was truly sure that's what it was. I called my mama because I wanted her to call him and tell him about himself. Don't be telling her baby she got cancer like that one time she told the school worker not to be talking down on her kids. Or like that one time she told our babysitter, "Don't tell us we can't eat our food." Then, finally moved to my first room after being admitted into the hospital. It was the ICU. It was never told to me what stage cancer I was in. I was always told it's aggressive. After 8 rounds of chemo, after 2 bone marrow tests, after various trips to the hospital for infections, after losing my hair, after 4 non-successful tries of getting stem cells, after telling my son I had cancer, after not having an appetite, after many restless nights, after not being able to daydream about traveling to places with no signs. Of cold weather anywhere. I finally got good news. Besides finding out the chemo was working, there was no evidence of the disease. I got stem cells. I made them on my own with the booster shot, of course. For these new stem cells I was about to receive, I'm going in the hospital for 1 month, take chemo for 7 days. This may have been the hardest chemo I have ever gotten, but I made it to transplant day. Wipe my system out and receive a new beginning. It's like filing Chapter 7 bankruptcy in my body. I wanted to go home and heal there. I'm living my life after cancer. I enjoy every day as my last because I don't know how much time I have here. Wow. One thing I was always worried about is if the cancer will ever come back. The thing about cancer is that it's not a cure, so I'm not fully cured of cancer. I'm just living my life like it doesn't exist. This time, when I daydream, is really to take the trip to the Bahamas with my new surviving cancer earrings and I survived cancer t-shirt. The biggest daydream is really a reality because it involves being cancer-free.
Tondalea Taylor's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project. Taylor was also a guest on the new podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WGTD comes from Quick Trip. They've got you covered with fresh fruits, coffee, desserts, and more, tailored for your busy life. Quick Trip, they've got you covered. Visit quicktrip.com to find the nearest location.
WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly fun. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks defeated the Orlando Magic 127-110 on Tuesday night. Milwaukee has run four in a row in five of its last seven. The UW men's basketball team is scheduled to host Illinois State tonight. The Marquette men's basketball game against St. John's, scheduled for today, was canceled due to COVID-19. Sunny for the northern half of the state today, a mix of sun and clouds elsewhere, highs ranging from around 10 in the north to the upper 20s in the south.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. You know, whatever I say on this program, whatever I do, reflects the work of several people and sometimes many. This show is staffed by a 24-hour team of editors and producers. So let's hear from them. As 2021 ends, we ask producers to talk about their most memorable stories of the year.
Hey, I'm Ryan Bank. My most memorable moment was Noelle King's conversation with TV legend Russell T. Davies. Davies just released a new limited drama called It's a Sin. It was loosely based on his life coming into adulthood as a gay man in London just as the AIDS crisis broke out.
I still have people I know and I think about to this day, I wonder if they died.
Really?
My friend Eddie. Where Eddie is, I don't know if he died. And it's very interesting that I've never gone to look him up because part of me doesn't want to know. There's still these blocks in my mind where I think, no, leave Eddie where he was, leave him. Maybe he's happy somewhere. Good old Eddie. Lovely boy.
That line still shoots a shiver up my spine. During the AIDS crisis, it could feel like some people just up and disappeared. They'd be vibrant sparks of life, and then whoosh, they'd vanish away. And all these years later, you may not really know or want to know what happened to them.
I'm Lisa Wiener. A piece that will stick with me is the profile we did of an Afghan refugee family, the Mohib family. Rachel Martin, our editor, H.J. Mai, and I met with them at a hotel where they were staying in an office park in Northern Virginia. They had been living there for weeks.
The hotel room is sparse. There's a small kitchen where her family is finishing up a breakfast of fried eggs and Afghan bread.
Is it sesame or poppy seed?
Maybe the sesame. Poppy seeds are the black ones.
The black ones. Mm-hmm.
That moment felt really small and unremarkable during our recording, but it quickly became my favorite scene when we put the whole story together. I hadn't appreciated just how daunting and exhausting all those everyday, trivial things can be when you're new to a country, like learning the names of the ingredients in your breakfast.
My name is Avery Keatley, and I'm a producer for Morning Edition. One of my favorite radio moments this year came from barbecue pitmaster Rodney Scott. We asked him about the first time he roasted a whole hog by himself when he was about 11 years old.
We always, you know, get on one knee and look under the hog to see it while it's cooking to make sure you don't burn it. So all day long, I'm looking under this hog, nervous. I'm this kid. And this guy was watching me from a distance to make sure I didn't screw it up. And when they flipped it over, man, you talking about feeling accomplished. Wow, you couldn't tell me anything that day.
I love that you can still hear the pride and satisfaction in his voice all these years later. In a year when so much of our coverage was really difficult, this moment of a young kid proving himself stands out to me as a beacon of joy.
My name is Lily Quiros, and earlier this year I spoke with Melvin and Nestor, a Salvadoran father and son, who had been separated at the Texas-Mexico border in 2018 under the Trump administration.
Yo, toditas las noches,
Every night I had the same dream, that I was there, where they kept me. In my dreams, I felt like I was reliving it all again. Those dreams made me feel really bad.
I would notice him looking very sad, without any motivation.
Following the separation, Nestor had nightmares in which he'd sometimes wake up crying. For some, this kind of trauma never goes away. I wanted to make sure that these people and the trauma they suffered were not forgotten.
Hey y'all, I'm Victoria Whitley Berry, and this year I reported on the rise of LGBTQ plus characters in children's television. And if you know me at all, you would know that I would basically talk your ear off about some of my favorite queer cartoons. And so I kind of wanted to talk about that with an actual kid. I called up 12-year-old Tommy McFarland, and when I was talking with them, I could not stop myself from just going on and on about how these shows would have had a huge impact on me if I had them when I was a kid. And Tommy surprised me because here I was, geeking out over the first queer wedding in a kid's show, and Tommy was like, duh, why wouldn't there be a gay wedding?
Why does this show need a gay character? Because gay people exist. Literally, gay people exist in the world. You're going to walk outside, there's going to be a gay person.
I really made it a priority to cover a lot of stories with trans people in them, especially stories like anti-trans legislation that was cropping up all over the country. But to me, that should not be the only reason we talk to trans people. And so hearing Tommy be so confident about who they are at such a young age, it honestly kind of gave me some hope. And of course made me feel a little old, but in a good way.
I'm Barry Gordimer. Over the summer, Arkansas threw away 80,000 doses of COVID vaccine. They'd reached their expiration date without anybody taking them. At the same time, hospitalizations and deaths were spiking. I traveled to Arkansas with science reporter Ping Huang. We talked to vax and anti-vaxxers. Two moments summed up the divide. The first came from pharmacist Tammy Killebrew. She was begging people to get vaccinated.
Prior to the vaccine, I was heartsick because people died and we couldn't help them. And now they don't get the vaccine. We can't help them. And so after every death, I go back to the pharmacy and I cry and then I go back to work.
Then there was Debbie Reynolds.
I'm not going to take the vaccine. They think we're stupid. How many people do you see laying around on the sidewalks and in their yards dying of COVID? Nowhere.
I was haunted by a distrust of government, of healthcare, of institutions that was so deep that people were dying needlessly.
I'm Nina Krivinsky. One of my most memorable moments was at the very beginning of 2021, when vaccines were just starting to roll out. Communities were making lists of who they wanted vaccinated first. Among those on the Cherokee Nations list were Cherokee language speakers. I produced this conversation between Steven Skeep and Mita Nix, a fluent Cherokee speaker.
When you preserve this language, what is it that you're preserving?
Everything. Our culture, our beliefs, our ways.
Nix loves to sing, especially hymns in Cherokee. She teaches them to fifth graders to help them learn the language. I'm not really a religious person, but I think I'll always remember the way Nix's voice here made me feel at such a difficult but also hopeful point in the pandemic.
Morning Edition producers with some of their most memorable moments of 2021. On Morning Edition from NPR News, I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. Thanks for tuning in today for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear the program weekdays from 5 to 9 a.m. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR every hour. Plus, you can find more news on our website at WPR.org. Stay tuned. Classical music coming up after the news.
Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, offering an engaging global education with funding for internships, research, study abroad, and more. Lawrence.edu.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
88.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's 9 o'clock now. We're getting ready for morning class.